Okay, Uncle Bill has written down some notes of some things that he wanted to talk about. I'm sorry to have to make you repeat everything that you just told me.
Well, some people aren't aware that the bombardier flies the plane on the final approach over your target. The pilot flies the plane up to the target, but about the last minute or so on the final run, he switches over to the pilot, and through the Norden bomb sight, he controls the actual flying of the plane. And whatever corrections he makes on the bomb sight, the plane would fly accordingly. And we had a pretty good bombardier on our crew. It's pretty accurate.
And is this the man that you are still corresponding with?
Yes.
And his name is?
Jan Begg.
Jan Begg.
He lives in Reseda, California. And during our course of training, even the pilots had a very short session with learning to use a bomb sight. They had a scaffolding, sort of a tower that would, you'd climb up on top and then sit up there looking into the bomb sight. Down below, they had a automatic BB gun that would, you would track your target, and then when you were on sight, you would pull the release, and that would shoot a BB into the target, and then you could see whether you're accurate or not. That was a type of training the bombardiers used, but then the pilots also had the type of training in what they called a link trailer trainer. It was a hooded replica of an airplane cockpit. And when you sat inside, you were strictly on instruments to fly. You couldn't see anything. You just flew by watching your instruments, which can be very tricky. You had to be taught to rely on your instruments, not your feelings, because if you made a turn and then straightened up, you would swear you were still turning the opposite direction because of the fluid in your ears. It would give you the sensation that you were turning and you might be straight and level, but if you went by your instincts, you'd overcorrect and be going the wrong way. That also had a desk where a GI could monitor your progress, and he had a control where he could put in turbulence and wind drift and everything you'd have to correct in order to stay on your course. And then you also had radio beams that you would follow, and they had what they used, the letter A and the letter N. One was da-da and the other was a da-dip. And if you were on course, you would get a steady hum. If you drifted one way, you would get the N signal. The other way, you would get the A signal. So that was how you would stay on course. You use that for cross-country flying, because they had these radio beacons so many miles, and they would be have rotating flashing beams on them. And during the day you could use your radio, and at night you could follow the searchlight beams. And another thing I happened to think about was the time we were down in Tampa, Florida. We had a plane go down in the Gulf of Mexico, and they sent out some of our crews to use what they call a grid search to look for their wreckage. You just fly back and forth on a grid system and looking for wreckage. We were flying about 500 feet over the water. We didn't spot them, but I don't know. Somebody else probably did. Another experience I had was when we were training for bombing missions on the B-17, we were briefed to hit a target, I think it was Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and we were to fly at a given altitude, maybe 10,000 feet, at a certain compass bearing, and drop our bombs. We had sand-filled 100-pound bombs that we were just practice bombs. We had this target like a bullseye painted on the ground, and you could see where your bombs hit, and you could tell whether your sighting was accurate. Mm-hmm. And at the time on this mission, I was the co-pilot, and the pilot, of course, was busy watching the directions and the course and everything. My main concern was more to be a lookout, because, you know, all of a sudden you see a plane coming head on the exact opposite direction, coming from on the same target from 180 degrees different. It was quite a sensation, and I just grabbed the controls and whipped that thing up on its end. When you set up the B-17 up like that, it's quite a feat. And of course, all the crew members, what the hell happened? And after it leveled off, I said, didn't anybody see that? All said, no. He went flying by us. Of course, we're flying maybe 175 miles an hour, and he's traveling that fast the other way, so that's a 300 and some mile an hour rate of closure. That's mighty quick. But that's just one of the experiences you have when you're training. As far as I know, we had the right briefing, but evidently this other one got the reverse briefing because he came at exactly the opposite direction.
Now, an incident like that, would you have to report that?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what happened to the other?
That was the co-pilot's duty to keep a log of every flight. At the beginning of the flight, you would start out, you'd take this log, it was kept in the side of the plane, you'd take it out, write down every crew member's name, rank, and serial number. Any experiences that happened over the trip, whether a certain motor sounded bad or anything at all. Mm-hmm. And when you landed, you would fill in a report of any problems that you had. One time I came in on I think it was an AT-6 I was flying at that time. I came in for landing, and all of a sudden I got a wind gust, a crosswind, picked up my wing and just flipped me up. But fortunately at that time I was young and I had quick reflexes, and I threw the power to it and straightened it out and got down the runway and pulled over to the parking place. And I got out my report and made a report of, they call that a ground loop.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really think they had to do any repair work. Maybe they had to put a new piece of skin on it or something. I didn't do any structural damage, but I did just skin the tip.
When you went to visit Marana 2 years ago, how much had the base changed from what you remember it? How many original buildings were?
Not very many. Just the only ones that were left were hangars and some of the brick buildings that were the permanent officers' quarters, and that all the wooden barracks were all gone.
Mm-hmm. Were you at Marana when the war ended?
I think so. I'm not really sure.
And did you go right home after the war?
I went to Rantoul Field in Illinois and got my discharge papers there. But at that time, the officers weren't discharged. You got a, I forget what they called it, in case anything happened, they had to recall you. We were still on call as far as they were concerned. But I had an honorable discharge after I got my basic training, and then became an aviation cadet. They discharged me and re-enlisted the same day, only 5 minutes difference. But I got a discharge as an enlisted man and re-enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I might have them in my wallet. I think I do, still carrying them all these years.
Just in case, right?
Yeah. Never know when you might need something.
There we go. School District of the City of Holland.
I still have that. I've been retired for 6 years and I'm still carrying that.
So can you just tell me briefly what has happened since the war? When were you married, and then where did you first live? And
Well, I was interested in photography, so when I got out, I took advantage of the GI Bill, enrolled in the Ray School of Photography in Chicago, Illinois, took their course in basic photography in black and white, and graduated from there. Then I went to Kansas. It was in Kansas City, Kansas, I guess it was. And I got in a course in color photography there. And that was working with the dye transfer system. That was a very expensive type of photography in those days. And it's what they used for commercial advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got finished with school, I went back home. I had my own photographic business. I operated out of my house, my folks' house, for maybe a year or so. And then I was a member of the VFW, so I took a lot of pictures for them. I was their post historian. I took all the photographs of the events that went on during the years. And then I met a fellow there that had a house in Blue Island that he bought, and he had two apartments, one down and one up. And we got talking, and he said, "Why don't you rent it and convert it into a photo studio?" So I took him up on it, and turned the living room into a photo studio, and then lived in the back end of it. And that's Fran, lived next door. That's where I met her, and got married on May 5th in 1951. At the time, she was working at Jewel in the I was working at the photo labs. I was home all the time, so I did the cooking and it worked out pretty good. And after after we were married about a year, I guess, we lived on my salary, and then what she made, we stashed in the bank, and that's how we got our down payment and got our own home. And we had a shell put up, and then we finished all the interior. Mm-hmm. And that was many moons ago. Now the kids are all grown up, out on their own, and raising families of their own.
Is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything for future history that you'd like to say? Or
for future history?
Here's the big moment to make your mark. Well, just what was your feeling towards the war? What was your attitude towards the enemy? Was there a national unity? I don't know how to explain it. What was just your...
Well, back in those days, Hitler was a rat, and everybody hated his guts. And it was different than the... it was a lot different than the Vietnamese War, which was a crazy thing that we didn't have to get into in the first place and shouldn't have, but... World War II, everybody felt that they attacked us and we were defending ourselves, and everybody was patriotic, and men, women, everybody, the women took over men's jobs in the factories, and I was working at Bar and Black when I enlisted, and we were making bandages, of course, for the war effort. And we had received some kind of achievement award for excellence in service or whatever. I still have it. I just looked at it the other day and never realized, but the thing is sterling silver.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe we can just wrap it up here. I just want to thank you for taking the time to...
Well, probably come up with some other stuff in the meantime.
Okay, maybe I can just send you copies of all of this and maybe some of the pictures of you that you sent me to...
out my memory.
Hopefully bring back some more stories, and I think that'll do it for now. Before we started the recording, Uncle Bill told me the story of the Cotton Queen, and I'm not going to let him go without telling it. Although I probably just ruined it, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, during your army travels, you go from base to base, and of course you, when you have free time, you go off base. You don't want to be on your own, so you look for companionship. I bought a new uniform in a tailor or military store there, and there was a real nice gal that waited on me. So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? So I asked her for a date, and she accepted. And we went out several times, and later on I discovered that she was the Cotton Queen.
And where was this at?
This was in Turner Field, Albany, Georgia.
Albany, Georgia.
Going home?
Bye, Kathleen.
Thank you. We'll probably see you sometime.
Tell Mama I said hi again. I will, and I'll give her your present. Thank you.